Okay, first of all, let me start by saying I had no idea what anyone was going to say here. But that's okay, because I do think that some of that the issues that were raised by the two talks, you know, bear very significantly on what the point of social epistemology is as a field, and where we've come from and so forth. And a lot of the concerns that Joan especially was evoking in her talk were ones that were there at the very beginning. And I do think one of the things, you know, if I had to give you a sense as to why I wanted to found this field, social epistemology, it was basically to fill a kind of gap that was very striking at the time, and this is in the 1980s, but was already striking for at least 10 years before I got on the scene. And that was, on the one hand, you still had a kind of epistemology and philosophy of science establishment that claimed to be very normative, but what exactly did the norms apply to? Right? So we've got epistemologists who are giving definitions of knowledge that nothing in the world satisfies. We have theories of rationality to which no agents, individual or collective, conform to. What kind of norms are these? Okay? So it was the vacuousness of the norms, especially on the analytic epistemology and philosophy of science side, that motivated me to want to start social epistemology as a normative project. Because there was a sense in which the normative had gotten lost in abstraction. Okay? And in this respect, somebody like Karl Popper was a very important thinker in my development, because this was a guy who definitely had very idealized ideas about what the norms of science should be, based on, you might say, best practice of science. The best scientists are the falsifiers. And what was his attitude? His attitude was, he was going to ram this down everyone's throats, because he recognized that the actual practice of science didn't conform to the norms, and so he was going to make it his point to criticize everything in sight. Okay, and there's a very long and distinguished tradition of that within the Popperian tradition, Lakatos, Feyerabend, and people of that kind. Those guys understand normativity. Okay? Because they've got a sense of what the norm should be, and they realize the world doesn't conform to it. And rather than just talking to each other and publishing journal articles, what they do is they actually start attacking scientists, they start attacking everybody. Okay? That's normativity. That is something, in a way, that needs to be revived, right? That the strong sense of normativity is tied to a sort of critical attitude toward taken-for-granted notions. And this has always been there in my conception of social epistemology. It is really still not there in the philosophy of science or epistemology in the analytic tradition. They are still talking abstractions that don't apply to anything. So when you hear somebody talk about reliable processes of knowledge, I haven't a clue what they're talking about. I understand the formal definition, and I understand the moves in the game one makes if one's engaged in that language game. But what in the world does it apply to? Who knows? And what would you try to do in order to make the world conform to this definition of knowledge? Even more obscure. In fact, most analytic epistemology would have been condemned by the logical positivists as metaphysics in the worst possible sense. Okay? And in a sense, this is, you know, if those of you who are familiar with the institutionalization of philosophy will know that within analytic philosophy especially, there is a strong distinction between epistemology and philosophy of science. Right? And the philosophers of science, for better or worse, at least have some regular contact with the sciences they philosophize about. Not always for better, but the point is they do have some kind of accountability organized with regard to the sciences. Epistemology is about epistemology and epistemologists talking to each other. They have no impact on anything. Not even on philosophy of science. Okay? Now this is a real, from the sociology of knowledge standpoint, this is a real pathology within the institution of philosophy. Okay? Now in a sense, social epistemology, this has been happening now, you know, as I said, this was already happening when I got on the scene, and it's still happening. And in a sense, social epistemology was meant to be a response to that issue. Okay? Now, how does one respond to that issue? Well, this is where all this interest that I, you know, my training in history and philosophy of science, like Joan, and the fact that I've been, you know, been very much influenced by science and technology studies and the sociology of scientific knowledge, all of that was very important in terms of coming up with a kind of empirically robust account of how science actually operates. So that if one is interested in legislating or prescribing for science, one should know what one's, you know, doing, right? What one's dealing with. What is the nature of the object that one is trying to govern here? And there it seems to me that the empirical and historical stuff is vital for, you know, especially for any kind of philosophical position that pretends to call itself naturalistic. Because nowadays, naturalism has a kind of pseudo-existence in philosophy. It's basically a branch of analytic philosophy that has only marginal connection with anything having to do with natural science or social science or anything like that. Okay? And so, in a sense, what social epistemology was designed to do was actually to bridge this kind of gap. And in a way, to come up with what you might call empirically responsible, or at least responsive norms that could be used to govern science. And so in that respect, issues like science policy and so forth would be the natural forum in which social epistemology would operate. Okay? And one could think of, you know, other kinds of mediating sort of positions like science communication and rhetoric and things like that as kind of the place where social epistemology should really find itself. And to a certain extent, of course, people like Joan have done this. Right? But it's still a very marginal way of thinking about the field, because the field called social epistemology is mostly about talking about what social epistemology is. It doesn't do it, it just talks about it. Right? And that's why issues of social ontology never quite get off the ground, and, you know, and that the definitions of knowledge really don't get far beyond what they were in 1963. Okay, is because there's a sense in which the challenge hasn't really been fully met within philosophy. Now, Joan is equally right, by the way, that the sociologists really never cared much for any of this. And I do think it's very important to realize that the people in science and technology studies, who people in this audience might be inclined to call sociologists, perhaps even me, but, you know, Latour and Bloor and Barry Barnes and all the Harry Collins and all these people weren't trained as sociologists. I wasn't trained as a sociologist. Okay? In a sense, what we're talking about with the science and technology studies is a kind of sociologization of various philosophical issues. Okay? You see, and so in this respect, you know, this is one reason, and for those of you who aren't familiar with the sociology of sociology as a discipline, that science and technology studies is pretty marginal to sociology. In fact, my guess is, you know, you could toss a coin as to whether philosophy or sociology does more to ignore the science and technology studies. It's a toss-up. Okay? Because within sociology, as you may know, there's a kind of well-developed kind of indigenous, you might say, form of sociology of science through Robert Merton. And that one kind of mirrors the sort of classical philosophy of science view. And they sort of exist in a kind of complementarity. And so science and technology studies is in some other space from that. And what's valuable about science and technology studies, and let me just underscore this, because 25 years later, it's quite easy to be very critical about science and technology studies, about its various excesses and so forth, and they're certainly there. But one of the things that was very good about it, and I think does remain very good about it, is that it is very, it really causes us to think in very fundamental ways about what we mean about science and technology, and the extent to which we want to see these things as separate from society. Right, because one of the big long-standing lessons of science and technology studies is that if you really take science and technology seriously, it's everywhere and it's integrated with everything. And in a sense, a lot of these metaphysical moves that Joan was talking about, in fact, are kind of theoretical responses to this empirical fact. Namely, science and technology isn't just, as it were, something you can put in a box and institutionalized in any kind of straightforward way. And so in that respect, it's a kind of difficult thing to provide norms for, because when you really, if you really take it seriously at the empirical level, science and technology is so far everywhere that you might as well be talking about just governing society or governing the world. Okay? And I think, in a sense, for the science and technology studies person, that point, namely that you cannot bound the field within which you are offering norms to science and technology, right? Because normativity typically presupposes some sense of closure, some boundary, some realm, some domain that you are governing. But if the domain, supposed domain you're talking about, has no clear boundaries and just goes off into every direction, then how do you govern it exactly? What does regulation mean exactly under those circumstances? And I think that's a very serious challenge that science and technology studies poses to people like myself and, you know, those of you who are interested in the normative side of social epistemology, is exactly, you know, what does, you know, how do you govern this very diffuse thing that in a sense covers everything and everybody? Now here I think we get into an issue about what's at stake in even keeping the term science in particular. Because one of the things, and again Joan was alluding to this in her talk, is that one of the things that you've seen over the past 25 years is that the univocal idea of science, that is to say, the idea that there is one concept of science, one norm of science to which all other forms of knowledge either have to be integrated into or governed by or unified under or something like that, that univocal conception of science, the thing about which the scientific method was supposed to give us some information, is no longer believed to a large extent. Right, so especially in light of what we call the postmodern turn, there is all of this stuff about science says, knowledge is, right? You stick an S on the end of everything, right? And so there's this kind of promiscuous pluralism that seems to govern the way we think about things, which makes normativity very difficult, right? It makes the normative task very difficult, because if you really start going down the route of science and technology studies, even a little bit, and so one person who may have been in the back of Joan's mind, but certainly people here will be familiar with, is Nancy Cartwright, right? If you've got these kinds of ideas of there being a disunified or multiple or pluralistic ontology, and in a sense every science is dealing with a somewhat different ontology, then you can start asking the question, what is the value of continuing to talk about all these things as sciences in any kind of normatively privileged sense? Why don't we just kind of be a complete relativist about this and say, look, when you're doing biology, you got to operate with the biology ontology. When you're doing economics, you operate with the economics ontology. You know, and you sort of play a kind of reified version of the language game move. Right? So, you know, this is, in a sense, Nancy Cartwright can be seen as kind of Wittgenstein with gas. Right? In a sense, you sort of take a view that every language game has its own rules, its own governing structure, right? And now what you do is you take the entities that are generated by those language games as constituting autonomous realms that only partially overlap with each other. That's how you get from Wittgenstein to Nancy Cartwright, basically, it seems to me. And what you get under the circumstances then is you start calling into question whether there is any kind of unified notion of science, some univocal notion of science that's worth having an argument about with regard to norms. Okay? Now let me remind you, of course, historically, the reason why we had those arguments was that we somehow believed that science was the best form of knowledge. That science and that scientific inquiry or scientific practice was in some sense a kind of optimal epistemic existence, right? It was the gold standard, right, to which other forms of knowledge and being aspired, okay? And this was not invented by analytic philosophers. This is very much part of the Enlightenment heritage and very much part of the self-understanding of modern people. Right? So in a sense, there's quite a lot at stake, in a way, in getting rid of the idea that there is this ideal normative standard. Now, I have not given up the ghost on this, so let me just point that out, because people often get my position confused. I, in fact, am a supporter of the Enlightenment, okay, but I believe one has to deal with this with open eyes and to realize what a struggle it is going to be to, as it were, in some sense, reestablish some kind of univocal or unified or normatively, preeminent notion of rationality or science or objectivity or whatever. That this is a real challenge if you take the world as it is, in terms of a diversity of its knowledge practices, seriously. Now, there's one more issue that comes up here that I want to flag, because in a way, this is in light of the fact we have Stefan Sorgner, Germany's leading transhumanist, up there in the back. And it's because, those of you who've been following any of my work in recent years, last 5 years or so, is I've become increasingly interested in what I've been calling humanity 2.0. And in a sense, this is the kind of metaphysics, because the issue is, it's true that I'm, as a person, I was very deliberate about calling social epistemology epistemology rather than metaphysics, and Joan did capture very well kind of what my sensibility is on this. But I do think that one of the interesting kind of metaphysical issues that arises, if you really take this idea of normativity seriously, this kind of gold standard notion of normativity seriously, is something that has certainly developed more and more over the course of my career. And that's the idea that, let's say that Popper's method of conjectures and refutations is the way to go, that is really the way to get the best possible form of knowledge. But then you also know from the empirical studies that are done on human beings, that human beings just aren't really cut out to be that way. There's lots of biases, prejudices. You can maybe arrange certain social groups to be able to behave in the way Popper wants, but it's very difficult. And a similar story can be said for every other norm of rationality. So then what do? Do you just give up the norm of rationality, or do you change the entities? Right? Do you change the people? And not only that, perhaps not only change the people, replace the people. Okay? So in other words, if we really, and this was already beginning to be thought about when I was starting out in my career, because some of you who are familiar with some of the early artificial intelligence stuff, Herbert Simon, people of that kind, right? Automated discovery programs, where you can end up, Herbert Simon's great dream before he died was to come up with this algorithm that would enable you to generate all the discoveries in the history of science from, a set of principles. And then what you could do is, you could just turn the science over to the computer. You could outsource it. Right? So in other words, all the philosophy of science that we've been doing for the last 150 years, our biggest mistake about was that we thought it was a theory of the human being. But in fact, it was the theory of the computer. Okay? Now that's an interesting point, right? And by the way, I'm not the only crazy person who says this. If you're familiar, analytic philosophers may know about Paul Humphreys. Paul Humphreys, the philosopher of science at the University of Virginia, he's written a book very much along these lines, that basically, if you take something like an instrumentalist theory of the philosophy of science seriously, and maybe some mild realist versions as well, and you're thinking about what is the best, what sort of entity could actually live up to the standards of those accounts of science, you would say it was a computational device. And a human being, as it were, is just a rough draft. And so when we're doing philosophy of science, we're really sort of, we're sort of really making the norms are really blueprints for the next generation thinker. Okay? Now I do think, if you follow any of the discussions in transhumanism, this whole line of argument is not unfamiliar. You get a lot of this kind of argument all over the place with regard to various things to change people, to make them kind of match certain kinds of norms. And I do think that maybe the time, in a way, has come. Part of the way to engage the normative issue and the metaphysical issue at the same time is to think about what exactly is the kind of being that we are trying to promote by promoting norms of the scientific method. Okay? Because historically, norms of the scientific method and even norms of scientific inquiry as seemingly rich as, let's say, John Dewey, okay, really, if you look at what these guys are talking about, they're really only covering a relatively narrow bandwidth of the entire human existence. And so one might say, well, if this is the stuff that really matters, if this is the stuff that really distinguishes us as creatures that we call science, then in a sense, a lot of this, what's the status of all the other stuff that we've got that sort of gets in the way of our being able to do the science right? Okay, and I think this then starts to raise a question about what, you know, the relationship between the norms we're putting forward and the kinds of beings that we are trying to promote in the world under the rubric of scientific normativity. And I think I'll stop there since we might have a little time for questions. Okay, thank you very much.